You're listening to ACB Radio. I'm Jonathan Mosen. Time now for another Blind Line highlight. This is an interview with Jim Fruchterman of Arkenstone, the people that bring you an open book and a range of other adaptive technology devices, including Strider. I began by speaking with Jim Fruchterman about how he became involved in assistive technology.
My involvement in the blindness technology business was actually different than most of the other folks I've run into in our industry. I didn't have any blind friends or relatives, or any connection to the field other than when I was in college, I thought of building a reading machine for the blind. I thought it was the only really good idea I came up with in college, and then years later I had a chance to actually build it.
What made you think about building a reading machine for the blind at college time?
Well, I was, in a graduate course in the 70s on pattern recognition and optical technology. That was where I was spending a lot of my academic interests, and all the examples were, yes, and you can use this neat technique to figure out how to blow up the airfield or find the tank in the battlefield and blow it up. So when I went off to think about, a project for that year, I thought, well, what other sort of applications would there be for this kind of technology? And the thing that I thought of was a reading machine for the blind. And my professor, was very supportive, but he pointed out that the technique that I was talking about wouldn't work accurately enough, and that somebody had tried it, something along those lines. So I was a little let down, but years later I found out that, a different way of doing the same thing, and of course, one of the first applications I thought of was to make a reading machine, and that was actually when I co-founded Calera Recognition Systems in 1981. And we talked about the different applications, and it actually took me 9 years or 8 years before I got a chance to actually get out and make a reading machine, and that was when Arkenstone was founded.
So what were you doing in the intervening period between college and Calera?
I was a rocket engineer. So when people say, are you a rocket scientist? I can say, yes, I am a rocket scientist. I was with the first private launch vehicle company in the United States that was going to compete with NASA. I was the main electrical engineer, so I built the electrical systems that loaded the fuel on the rockets and telemetered the data from the rocket, and was supposed to blow up the rocket if it went off course. Luckily, it wasn't necessary. The rocket blew itself up before it actually took off the launch pad, so I didn't have to test that system in real life.
But that seems like quite a diversity of a career shift, going from rocket science to optical character recognition.
Well, I was an electrical engineer, and it was at a time period when electrical engineers were equally likely to be working in radio technology as custom chips and computers, and the link to optical character recognition was one of the guys on the rocket project, and I knew somebody at HP Labs that was a chip designer. And his suggestion to us was, well, instead of building general purpose chips like processors or memory, why don't we pick an application that a custom chip would do very well and make something possible that wasn't possible without it. And the application that he brought up was reading text, and that's how Calera got started. So, but the rocket experience was more an experience that showed me that I could make things happen, and that was my role at Calera. I was the more business oriented of the three founders, and actually was the finance officer for 5 years, and then the marketing VP. And so that was good background. But then I got to do something new that was something I'd been interested in for a long time.
And that was a pretty successful company. What actually motivated you to come back to this reading machine for the blind idea? I mean, it's not something that everyone would think of.
Well, when you've been at a company that you've founded for 8 years and you've had four presidents, which was what Calera had, because that was the way venture capitalists work, is they put in $25 million and they, wanted the best results, and if the results weren't there, they would fire the CEO and move on to another one. And so over that time period, you kind of come up with a list of things that you might want to do with this technology you've invented that aren't possible in that regime. We built a prototype reading machine for the blind at Calera. Bill Schwegler, who was one of the early founders of Arkenstone with me, built that prototype, and it was, you know, it cost $50,000. It used a $40,000 Calera reading system, scanner and PC, and we just knew that even then, this is the late 80s, that, you know, that $40,000 device would become a $5,000 device, would become software. That was already clearly going to happen. And so that was one of the things that it just seemed, you know, looking at Xerox, which is our major commercial competitor, that they'd been the only company in the reading machine market for probably 10 years. And it was a very nice thing that they were doing, but they certainly weren't being pushed. And so I had talked to a few blind people who'd been looking at Calera's products and decided that, gee, I could bring out a under $5,000 reading system that was PC-based and a lot more people could afford it. So, you know, people had been sort of circling around Calera talking about this. We built a prototype, and now, you know, after Calera hired a new president from Xerox, I went to him and said, you know, I want to go off and do this. And he says, well, I always liked the fact that Xerox did this, and Calera should do the same thing, but we're not going to do it in-house, so we'll support you in doing it. And that was how Calera got started. Arkenstone got started was Calera being very cooperative as long as I agreed not to compete with them and hire too many of their engineers away.
How did you get the name Arkenstone, and what does it mean?
Calera's original name was Palantir, which means the stone that sees, from J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings series. And it turned out that someone else had Palantir, and the company had to change the name quickly to Calera, which is the name of a wine, actually, in our area. And when it came time to start Arkenstone, it operated under names like Good Technology, Inc. I mean, that was sort of our, you know, original concept. You know, why can't we do something good with technology? Well, it's not lucrative enough. Well, we still want to do it. So the suggestion, I think, came from Bill Schwegler. Well, Palantir was a good name, even though we couldn't keep it. Let's go in that direction. He said, you know, an Arkenstone looks like a Palantir, and it's from the same series of books. And that's where the name came from. The other thing that it went, that we picked the name for was we knew that we were going to be bringing technology to people who weren't necessarily into technology, and names like Readtronics or, you know, having lots of X's and Q's didn't seem to have the right feel for it. And Arkenstone had more of a lower technology image. And, you know, obviously we've used that over the years to try to avoid intimidating people who are technology averse into using reading systems and trying to avoid delivering too much technology in their face and kind of making them worried about that.
And I guess good technology could have been a bit syrupy too, couldn't it?
Yeah, it was a little bit too flat. but you know, that's basically something that I've carried along with me through Arkenstone, and one of the things that I'm actively working on doing is encouraging the technology community to find ways to take technology that has a beneficial social application but which doesn't have a financially lucrative application, and finding ways to apply that. And I think that that aspect of technology is underserved, and we need to come up with more ways to pursue that. And one of the things that Arkenstone is Arkenstone turns out to be one of the most successful social entrepreneurship experiments in the United States' history, probably probably in the world, just in terms of a nonprofit using high technology techniques to deliver a social good that is not financially attractive to a high tech company. I mean, and you can see that from our industry, is that the making reading machines for the blind has been a very hard place to be doing business.
Mm. Can you talk a bit about what non-profit means in this context? Presumably it doesn't mean that you're not making money on this stuff.
Well, our goal is to not make much money. For instance, our historical profit ratio is 1% or 1.2%. It's very tiny. So basically our goal is to break even. the nonprofit structure has to do with more of our charter. I mean, for instance, there are many high-tech companies that don't make profits, but that's not necessarily that's not necessarily their objective. The nonprofit structure says that we're going to be exempt from taxes in the United States in exchange for a bunch of requirements that are placed on a nonprofit organization. And these are common requirements that are similar, you know, throughout the world, even though it may be a nonprofit association in Europe rather than a nonprofit corporation here. And those are all of our assets are dedicated to the public benefit. So, for instance, if we were to shut down Arkenstone, the money that would be left over from the sale of our inventory and such would have to be given to another nonprofit. They can't go to, say, the managers. So we look at Arkenstone as being run with the public being our shareholders. And the charter of a nonprofit organization is to do something that benefits society. In the case of the U.S. statutes, it has to be something educational or scientific or charitable, and that's generally the range that we operate under, is we're helping people with disabilities get education, work, by giving them the tools they need. But as far as the internal operations, we look like a regular high-tech company, except for our overriding objective, instead of maximizing profits for shareholders, is maximizing the use of the technology while financially not losing money.
How do you feel about the fact that there are obviously people all around the world depending on your organization and its technology for their livelihood and their education? That must seem like an awesome responsibility to be carrying.
Well, I guess I don't think of it as much of a crushing burden as the most fun thing I could imagine doing. You know, we do have an obligation, obviously, to our customers to deliver them the value for the money that they've invested in the product. We have an obligation to keep improving the product and reacting to their desires and needs, even though in many cases our users disagree and what that might be. We're spending more and more time trying to target different versions of the product to different groups of our customers so that we can deliver what that group wants better than what we could do, say, with the general purpose product or with something that was designed for another group. And that's fun. I mean, our users spend a lot of time giving us detailed feedback on what we can do. And, you know, our major challenge is the fact that we don't have infinite resources to deliver on everything that's possible, but we're extremely cost-effective compared to what a standard high-tech company would do. I mean, we build products for a tenth of the budget that I would have had at Calera to build a project.
How is that possible?
Mainly by avoiding core research and deep technology investments. To a great extent, we're building on top of someone else's core technology. And I think of us as acting as scouts for cool technology and then integrating them into our products. And because so much of the technology is developed for other applications that justify them economically, like the OCR industry being a several hundred million dollar a year industry, justifies the investment of 10 or 20 or 30 million dollars of R&D into improving OCR, the reading machine for the blind industry just can't justify that much. But since someone else is doing that work, we can essentially get that technology on the margin for marginal cost. And the marginal cost for OCR technology is not that high because, you know, we go to the vendors and say, give us a good price on your technology so we can integrate it. Something that we have a tendency to do is to try to grab more technology than you would find in a low-end product. So, for instance, we take CARES, you know, $1,000 to $5,000 product, and we try and pull more and more of those functions and features into our standard reading product. And they are trying to differentiate their high-end product from their low-end product, but our users want all those things that make OCR more accurate, more automatic in the product that they get. So that's a lot of what we do, too.
in terms of licensing that kind of new high-end technology, do you get, I don't know whether there's a better word, but sympathetic responses from the developers of this stuff who say, well, yes, we'll give it to you at a reasonable price because you're using it for people with disabilities?
We do. I mean, I think we basically get comparable pricing or better. We rarely get free, though we always would love that, because often we're dealing with companies that are more small to medium by high-tech terms. You know, my argument to companies would be, well, don't, you know, you don't have the money to give us stuff because you don't have a donation program, but give us a break, or treat us, instead of being a, you know, 5,000 unit a year customer, treat us like we're a 25,000 unit a year customer. And quite often we fall below the minimum requirements for an OEM arrangement with these companies, and they will make an exception and do a deal with us even if the quantities are low. Sometimes the discounts we get are extraordinary. For instance, our Atlas Speaks Talking Map product, the map database that we're using, when we introduced it, it was a $30,000 map database for one copy for one customer, yet we could make it available to a blind person for, you know, $500. Why is that? Because the company recognized that, you know, they weren't licensing map data of the whole country to Pepsi to, you know, optimally route their trucks. They were licensing it to us to use it as a convenience product for blind people, and so they've been very flexible in lowering prices so that we could, you know, keep pushing the price down into a more reasonable range than even where we started. So
there's been a lot of evolution in this industry in the last 10 years or so. Remind us of what the first Ark and Stone product for blind people was like.
Our first product was based on a talking PC. So if you had a PC that ran DOS and had a screen reader and a synthesizer built in, we would add a coprocessor board into that that, as I recall, cost roughly $3,000. Its commercial price at the time was probably $5,000, but we got a break from Clear on that. And then a HP scanner that was probably $1,500 or $1,600. So we were able to bring out a $4,500 add-on to a talking PC that made it into a reading system. And the timing was very good for us. Several things happened to make Ark and Stone's launching particularly easy. One was that Xerox had a $12,000 reading machine that everyone wanted but was hard to afford. Many, many people were migrating to the IBM PC platform with a screen reader, so they already had the prerequisites. And we had engineered the Calera product knowing that we wanted to do a reading system for the blind, so we put in a lot of features that we wanted to use into it. Since Bill Schweiger was the product manager and I was the VP of marketing, and my best friend Dave Ross was the head of engineering at Calera, we managed to organize it so that many of these features just made their way into that TrueScan board that we used as a base product for the Ark and Stone reader, which is our first reading product.
And given that you wouldn't have had a user base at that time, how did you determine the user interface for that product?
What we did, the initial user interface was the Calera standard user interface, where I had gone in and programmed the UI to use BIOS calls so that screen readers would pick them up very easily. So basically, it was the standard interface. One of our first users was Noel Runyon, who was local here in Silicon Valley and a prominent blind engineer and product developer, had been involved with the VersaBraille at Telesensory and all that. And Noel designed a different software interface called EasyScan. And it became very popular with his users, and it became clear that it was a much better interface than the one that we were shipping with, say, the first, you know, 100 or 200 Ark and Stone readers. And so we just licensed that technology from Noel, and then that became the main interface of the Ark and Stone reader. And this was the origin of the press the spacebar to scan, and the page would just be scanned, and then you would start listening to the text. That was the key innovation that Noel brought that made the product a lot easier to use, and has been one of the sort of base capabilities of the product ever since.
Now, you developed a self-talking product within Windows, and we'll come back and talk about SSIL shortly, but what interests me is whether you found that there was almost a psychological barrier for some users about that. I mean, that was a time when Windows was not considered very accessible to blind people. Did you get a reaction that said, gosh, this is working in Windows, yuck?
We did. I mean, for instance, in 1989 when we started Arkenstone, one of the first things I did was spend two or three months just talking to a lot of people before we actually started selling the product. And I learned a lot about how people thought we should build and market the product. The other thing I learned was that access to Windows was the number one concern. So I was talking to sort of the, let's call it the opinion leaders and the gurus in the blindness field. And so we already knew that Windows was going to be a big deal, and we knew that we weren't going to have the benefit of using the screen reader to do the talking. So that's when we, you know, set forth to make what ended up being the first talking Windows application. And I'd say we hid the fact that it was Windows from people as much as we could, just to avoid that concern. For instance, the product came with a copy of Windows bundled in it with a special simplified install that would run automatically so that someone didn't have to go through the inaccessible Windows install. And one of the ways we did it is we built our first standalone reading system, which was the first open book, which had all this installed, and then you just use a simple keypad to interact with it. And the fact that Windows was under the hood, as it were, was not something that someone had to deal with.
SSIL is now being used by probably, I would say, the majority of screen reader and other talking applications in Windows. You were pretty generous with the way you distributed that technology, which I presume came about as a result of your own Windows product.
Yeah, matter of fact, it came about because of something that Bill Schwegler had done at Calera that had turned out to be an industry standard in that industry. He had, with a very brilliant engineer, come up with something called the SIL, the Scanner Interface Library. And Calera had made it as a standard way for its applications to use scanners, and then spun that out as a separate company to become the scanner interface standard that was used for most of the last 10 or 15 years, up until when the Twain standard took over. So we had that as a model. We actually licensed some of the technology from that spin-out company to do the same thing in speech synthesizers, because it was clear to us already that the majority, well, everyone who's trying to write a talking application in Windows was spending a quarter of their time writing synthesizer drivers. And it added no value to the products whatsoever, but you had to do it. And so it actually was, the idea was that we would save net energy by putting out a free speech synthesizer interface standard that everyone could use, because then synthesizer makers would write one driver and a bunch of applications would be able to use their new synthesizer, and we'd all benefit from the sharing of that technology. And that's actually the way it turned out, you know, especially for international synthesizers. You know, other people have invested the time to write SSIL drivers for them, and that meant that we didn't have to spend all that time, and it meant that a whole bunch of application developers could focus on that. Now, because a standard like that is sort of a least common denominator standard, there was always a desire to pick a couple of synthesizers and really make them work really well. And people usually tended to basically do the deck talk, and then the SSIL would be that, the other synthesizer interface that, for instance, would help people who were using older synthesizers that no one would write drivers for anymore. They were still in a sale driver for it. They'd still be able to use the new products.
And yet, how do you feel about the fact that a pretty effective competitor of yours, such as Kurzweil Educational Systems, is using this stuff?
Doesn't bother me a bit. We all benefit. I mean, you know, one of the interesting things that people ask me is, well, you do that because you're a nonprofit. And probably we are more open to doing infrastructure work and just giving it away because we're nonprofit and because our charter is to promote better access to technology. I mean, for instance, when we came in the market and dramatically lowered prices for our products, people who wanted to stay in the market had to come down and match prices. And that meant that everybody would benefit because whether or not they bought our product, it was now possible for them to have choices at a better price point. And so that helps maintain the competitive nature of the market and give consumer more options. At the same time, if I was running this as a for-profit, I probably still would have done the SSIL because it net saved me a lot of time and effort and made made us more productive, and it was based on that shared cooperation. There are many areas where high-tech companies choose to cooperate in areas that it doesn't make sense to duke it out in because it's just a waste of resources. And there are many standards that fall into that classification. And I think most people think of standards cooperation as being a area of positive benefit for almost everyone concerned. And, of course, there are some notable exceptions to that.
Yes. You're doing other stuff, too, of course. Atlas Speaks and Strider, I believe, are still in the works. So you've got mobility products now. Can you tell us a little bit about those and how they became reality?
One of the first 10 users we had of the Arkansas Reader called me up and said, "Hey, Jim, all my life I've wanted to be able to read a book and to drive a car. And now, thanks to Arkansas, I can read a book. When are you going to help me drive a car?" And that really crystallized my understanding of what blindness presented in the way of challenges. It was, access to information was the common thread, but where it really was a significant drawback was in reading information and personal mobility. And while making a car that a blind person can drive is something that I'm firmly convinced will happen, it's not going to happen sufficiently soon for a lot of people. And so we kind of kept this need in mind. And then actually I was coming back from a Calera reunion picnic, and an engineer who had been at Clara was working for ETAC, which made digital maps, and she was chatting with Bill Schwegler, and her idea is, how about we get your talking technology together with our maps and make a talking locator for blind people? And so that was the origin of the Strider concept, and it turned out that it was easier for us to make the talking map product available, that's Atlas Speaks, and it's been on the market for a couple of years in the U.S., than it was for us to get the GPS product done. And one of the things that we did is we actually invested a fairly large amount of money in developing the technology, let's say hundreds of thousands of dollars. And when we had the Strider prototype, we had a product that worked pretty well for the techie user, but weighed too much, cost too much. And when we actually kind of looked at the market, we figured that it wouldn't cover its costs of continuing to do development on it. And so actually Strider's been on the back burner for the last year and a half at Arkenstone. And we've been out looking for money to continue developing it to get it to the place where I think it will be a very valuable product for blind people throughout the world. And I happen to think that that's under 2 pounds and under $2,000, but maybe it should be under 1.5 pounds and under $1,500 or something like that. But I don't think that, because Strider is a product that blind people buy for themselves rather than employers or governments tend to buy for them, getting the price point down and making the ergonomics usable are key. So Mike May, who's our VP of International Sales, has been working on trying to find different ways to bring financing for Strider to sort of bring about this continued development of it. And I think he's going to be successful. I think we have a number of grant applications in the works and collaborative efforts both here in the U.S. and overseas trying to find ways to continue to push this technology forward. Because I'm firmly convinced that there is a great portable talking GPS product in the future for visually impaired people, and just have to figure out the right way to bring it about.
At the risk of saying something controversial, perish the thought, I think that that cost, say $1,500 US or $2,000 US even, would be significantly less than the cost of training and maintaining a guide dog throughout its entire lifetime.
Well, I don't think that's the right comparison, though. And this is something that that we've been very clear on in our positioning of Strider. We divide the orientation mobility process into those two halves. Strider is an orientation device. It tells you where you are to the accuracy of the GPS and the accuracy of the map. That's on the order of 10 meters for both the map and the GPS. So we're very good, when everything's working well, telling you that you're near the street corner. We're not very good at telling you that there's going to be a light post, you know, straight ahead, and that you should walk around it. And that's the mobility part. And I think that the guide dog and the white cane are what keep people safe as they're traveling. I just think of us as making the information about where you are and about where the things you want to go to are, sort of the information you'd get out of the environment from reading a map, looking at street signs, looking at house numbers. That's the information that we're trying to make accessible, but we're not trying to replace the fundamental mobility skills someone needs. And that's a very different approach than, say, some of the electronic travel aids have tried to take that, you know, are trying to, in essence, deliver vision, a vision replacement technology. Strider's not that ambitious.
It'd be interesting to see how people feel when the product does go to market about this, because a number of people are quite competent cane users but choose to travel with a dog because, with familiar destinations, dogs do have kind of location facilities. If you go to a particular shop often enough, you can tell the dog a name for that destination and it will go there. That part of the advantage of a guide dog may no longer be relevant with the Strider device, and if you were a good cane user, you may choose to forego the, you know, the care and responsibility that goes with being a guide dog user in exchange for a Strider and a cane.
I think that one of the explicit objectives of Strider is to encourage independent travel to unfamiliar destinations. So that is absolutely, you know, we want you to be able to pop in an address, look, you know, explore the way to get there, get the best route, and then go out and just do it without the concern about getting lost. For some people, that may mean that they would make a different choice in terms of dog versus cane. I think Mike May, who, you know, is probably the he's been using a Strider continuously for the last 2 or 3 years now as the one prototype user, is a, you know, an avid guide dog user, and I think he just sees it as enhancing the value of his dog. But, you know, I think it's sort of up to different folks how they might do that. I think that we want to see Atlas Speaks and Strider being available to people to complement their choice of personal mobility technology and technique.
Atlas Speaks currently works just within the U.S., is that right?
Yes, it does. And one of the things that is happening, I'm hoping will happen in the next few months, is that we're going to switch the core map engine in Atlas Speaks from a pretty proprietary ETAC-centric format to one that can consume maps in a wide variety of different formats. And what this will mean is it'll make it a lot easier for us to, say, grab the TeleAtlas maps in Europe and have an atlas that works in those countries. And as a matter of fact, as I mentioned, we're actively looking at several collaborations on Atlas Speaks in both Europe and in Japan, and hoping that one of those will turn into a mechanism to pay for the map data from those countries. And just like we have a very favorable deal in the United States on map royalties, the major map supplier in Europe has also been sort of comparably generous in terms of not needing a royalty of what they normally would get for our access to their maps. So we just have to do the engineering work to switch to something that's a more open core engine for accessing map data.
Can Can you give me a real-world example of how a blind person uses Atlas Speaks?
I'll give you a couple examples. One is someone is going to go to a city, and they know that they're going to be staying in a certain hotel, they're going to be visiting certain business locations, they may be visiting a friend, and what they can do is pop those addresses in, get a feeling for where those things are relative to the airport, relative to their destinations, for instance, that, you know, this place is a mile east of that place is 20 miles northwest of, okay, so that's going to be a much longer ride. They can sort of get a familiarity with the key landmarks in that city. For instance, our map comes with the major tourist and educational, you know, sort of, and governmental landmarks all marked. So, for instance, if you're trying to plan a trip in Chicago, you'll find out that, you know, this place is near Wrigley Field, and that place is near the Loop, or that, you know, okay, the Museum of Art is here, and basically those things are just the same things that a sighted person uses a map or a guidebook to find out when they're planning their trip. So there's a very common thing. I guess anything that a sighted person uses a map for, any task or any information, the goal of Atlas Speaks is to deliver that same information and allow a blind person to perform that same task independently using that as their tool rather than a traditional two-dimensional paper map.
That sounds like an incredibly liberating thing, really, for blind people, especially in unfamiliar destinations.
Oh, our Atlas Speaks users are a rapidly excited group of people who love the product, and the whole struggle with Atlas Speaks is finding out for us that the price point Atlas Speaks needs to be at for blind people to be able to afford it is sufficiently low that it doesn't pay for a lot of engineering, and that's one of the challenges of our field. Is there are many great products that a lot of people like, sell in decent quantities, and bring in $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 a year, and that, you know, that does not pay for a software programmer. And so our goal in this area is really to find other sources of the capital to keep building these products, knowing that, you know, anytime someone gives us a grant of some technology or some money, that enables us to push the product forward and then offer upgrades to all the people involved. And they're not actually paying the full cost of that, because I think that it's going to take a really good Strider implementation to generate enough revenue to make this a self-supporting application, like the reading products are self-supporting.
And back to the reading products, in recent times you've been involved in developing products for people with learning disabilities, and one of the questions that comes up quite regularly that it should be reasonable to give you a chance to answer here is whether that has lessened Ark & Stone's commitments to blind people in the OCR market.
I think of it as a necessity, actually, to deliver better products for our blind users. And one of the challenges that Ark & Stone faces is there is a plateau in how many products you can sell in the blind field. And if you're going to continue to improve the technology, you can either continue to improve it sort of with the amount of revenue you're bringing in for those products, or you can try and seek other sources of money to pay for additional development. That's an issue I wrestle with all the time. And one of the things we found out when we surveyed open book users was that 20% of open book users weren't blind or visually impaired. They were people with dyslexia. And so here's a customer base of ours that's buying our product, and we can find money to work on that product. So, for instance, when we developed the Win product, we got, let's say, a third of the budget underwritten by IBM. IBM was very generous. They found this was an area that they wanted to support. And all of the development that we put into Win was actually the basis of a complete rewrite of Open Book. So, for instance, Open Book as a software product, as I said, you know, the first talking Windows product, was introduced in 1994, something like that. So, or 93, something in that time period. So, here's a product that's kind of creaky, and with the money we got with IBM and the like, and building Win, be able to build a completely new OCR product, and the actual user requirements for Win are less advanced than for Open Book. So we built this early version of the product, worked out some of the bugs, and then were able to turn that into a complete rewrite of Open Book. But the fact that that product is self-supporting and generating money, paying for more R&D, 80% of that R&D benefits our blind users. In other words, there's an 80% common code base between Open Book and Win.
Yeah, and yet there was a perception out there, wrongly, I guess, from your perspective, that because people with learning disabilities were having access to a 32-bit application first, et cetera, that they were being prioritized over blind people.
Well, and I think, kind of giving you the background, I felt that Win was a product we could get out the door quicker.
Mm.
And you know, most of that effort supported the Open Book effort, but it took us a lot more work to get the new version of Open Book, the Ruby edition, out the door, because we were trying to both gain the major improvements, core OCR improvements. And by the way, the major OCR improvements didn't come out in Win 1.0. They came out in Open Book Ruby edition. And now we're about to release Win 2.0, and now our dyslexic users are going to benefit from the advances in Ruby.
So they could be saying the same thing as the blind people were.
Right. Well, and that's really our goal, is to keep ping-ponging back and forth. But because we've now achieved basically in another significant leg to our reading machine efforts, the LD market, we've been able to pioneer, for instance, a lot of low-vision features that were designed originally for Win users, because of their visual needs, which are not related to vision loss, but instead to a learning disability. And it turns out that those vision improvements, which we probably would not have designed into Open Book, we left into the Open Book Ruby edition. Now we're hearing all this great feedback from low vision users saying, I love that feature. And then, of course, we've built a third leg to this reading machine triangle, which is we've built a very simple reading client, which again is based on the same code base but has about 5% of the complexity of Open Book, called Vera, which is our standalone reading machine. And you know, this is another product that we're now selling a fair number of that has a tape recorder-like interface to a reading system. So it's very simple. It comes in a mahogany box. So it looks like a piece of furniture. And it's aimed primarily at that technology-averse senior citizen losing their vision who would not consider using a computer because they're, in general, not from a generation that's comfortable with computers. And so together, each of these projects means that, for instance, we have more programmers on our staff because we have more revenue coming in covering those things. And it allows us, for instance, right now, WinPoint 2.0 is almost finished, even though the bulk of our engineering team is still working on Open Book technology, because, you know, we could stick one programmer off and say, okay, now turn Ruby into Win 2.0, and, okay, all you guys go off and work on these other things that are more Open Book related. So for us, we think we're a much stronger organization by diversifying in these directions. The blindness effort is still our core business, and yet we're financially in a stronger position and able to apply more resources to our blindness products than if we had stayed just in that market. So it's you know, it's a deliberate strategy, and I think it's been paying off for us, and we're hopefully going to be able to come out with more technology faster and better than we would have otherwise.
Is the take-up of Vera as high as you would have expected?
Actually, it's higher than I would have expected, but that's the difference between Jim Fruchterman, engineer, and our marketing team. You know, I like products that do a lot of things, and I relate very well to our technical customer who is looking for a reading product that offers maximum functionality and performance and can do more things and is asking for more bells and whistles. But our marketing people, you know, especially, for instance, here, one of the biggest customers we have is our Veterans Administration that buys reading machines for aging veterans of World War II or the Korean conflict. And they were putting tremendous pressure on us to deliver a product that was far more simpler than OpenBook. And, you know, my answer was, oh, but OpenBook is simple. And it is a very simple PC product, but it's not appliance simple. It's not like operating a tape recorder. And that was the demand. So from my standpoint, I was quite surprised at how many people wanted Vera, because they're people who have different needs than I do, or you know, the people I understand best were the techie types.
Now, OpenBook Ruby Edition is creating a lot of interest, and it's the latest product for the blind from Arkenstone. Do you think it was released a little early? There seemed to be a few maintenance releases, or at least one maintenance release pretty soon after its initial release to market.
Well, I think you've noticed in our entire industry that there are a lot of people doing a lot of releases. and I think that the thing we're finding is we're going to experiment more with wider beta programs, because we had some experiences with rapid releases, say, in the OpenBook 2 range. And we got a lot of complaints from users saying they didn't want as many releases. They wanted better tested releases. Came up with a more dedicated testing program. And when we released the first version of OpenBook 4, we were firmly convinced, based on our internal testing, that we had fixed all the bugs. I'd say all the major bugs. And then we went out there, and a few thousand people started using it, and we found a handful of significant bugs, which we had to patch. Right now, we're working on another version of OpenBook Ruby, with the primary goal being to internationalize it. We have a significant number of customers who are reading languages other than English. Say about a quarter of our customer base is reading other languages. And we've been basically finishing up, you know, or developing versions of OpenBook for German, Spanish, French, Italian, Dutch, the Scandinavian languages, Portuguese. And so we're in the middle of all these projects. And while we were working on those, we also fixed, I'd say, a handful of smaller bugs, but things that people were bringing up. And, you know, I think we did pretty well for a complete rewrite of a product.
Mm. It raises the question about the attitude of the blind community, or at least the part of the blind community that gets on the internet and participates regularly in listservs. Do you feel a little bit hammered at times by that part of the blind community?
It doesn't bother me a bit, but I worry about its impact on some other segments of the blind community. I have no problem laying out my point of view and explaining, you know, you think it should have been designed that way, and, you know, we probably should redesign it that way in the future, but we weren't omniscient. We couldn't have fixed that right at that point because we didn't think as clearly as you do. And there are many constructive pieces of criticism out there that we take, and there are many pieces of criticism out there that we don't take because we add it into the context of all our users and make a different decision. And other companies may make different decisions, other people may have made different decisions, but that's just the way everyone has to. We do our best in making our best decisions, and then we get out there, and if people want to call us on it, we'll defend our thinking, and if it turns out that we're wrong, we'll make changes, and I think that we can do that. The thing that worries me is the vitriol that comes from some people on the internet that does two things. First of all, the fact that everybody's integrity gets questioned extensively on the internet has always sort of bothered me, that people don't have the conviction of their opinions, that they can't let their opinions stand rather than implying that someone else who disagrees with them is stupid or immoral or commits terrible acts with small animals or whatever it is that seems to come out of the fingers of people using the internet. I just take that as part of the medium, but it's a part of the medium that I dislike, and I think a lot of other people dislike. And I think you see a lot of people not participating in the medium because of that. But the group that I hear from is, let's say on our user list, or there are a lot of people on there who aren't very sophisticated, for whom the Arkansas user listserv may be their primary link to the internet. They may not be doing a lot of email, but here's a product they're using, and they figure out how to do email. And they hear these terrible things from people that convinces them that the product is broken beyond all repair, that no one in their right mind could possibly be using it productively, whereas the reality is that we've introduced an upgrade that, you know, many thousand users are using, is far faster, more accurate, has tons of new features. And yes, there are these two things that either are broken or don't work as well, but they're features that weren't in the last version. But when people see this extreme negativeness coming across, they're paralyzed with fear to make a change from an older version of the product, which is just nowhere in the same class as the new version of the product. And I have to get out there and say, hey folks, you know, yes, there's some issues that people feel very strongly about, but if you're still using OpenBook 3, you're still going to see all these great benefits if you upgrade. And trying to get some of that balance in there is part of my job.
Do you think that this is a characteristic that's more emphasized in the blind community, or is it just the internet as a medium everywhere?
My experience is it's a standard characteristic of the internet.
Right.
That listservs tend to degenerate into these more negative flame wars. I mean, the whole concept of flame wars was around before there were really disability lists.
This is true.
And you know, it's just the nature of the medium is that people who have strong opinions, who are operating in isolation, have a tendency to allow the passion of the moment overtake their normal reserve that they might exercise, for instance, in a interpersonal conversation, and just say terrible things and send it. And then maybe half an hour later, they go, oh, I really probably shouldn't have been that hard. One of the things that I've learned to do is when I get an email message that makes me really mad, I write a really negative response, and then I save it as a draft. Then I come back 4 hours later or the next day, and I rewrite a much more temperate response. It works much better, and you don't regret what you've said.
What are your relationships like with the two major consumer organizations of the blind in the U.S., or do you maintain relationships with them?
Arkansas maintains relationships with both ACB and NFB. We have been pressured by both groups to not do stuff with the other group in the past. I think that that's a sign that we're kind of even-handed if we get sort of equal amount of grief. I think that there is less emphasis on that than there was in the early days of Arkansas's activities. I think that ACB and NFB have cooperated more on lobbying issues and issues of common interest over the last few years, and actually both groups have also cooperated with other groups in the disability field. And I think that's gotten some important legislation through, because when the disability groups are united, they are a powerful force that can push through some exciting stuff. However, we're not, we've never chosen to make ourselves aligned with one group over another, and it's always been our position that the political decisions of visually impaired people are up to them, and we respect the choices of that entire community to make their own choice. And, you know, that means we're going to show up at conferences that both groups put on. And we think that's, you know, the appropriate nature of our role in that.
Well, I have two more issues to deal with. One is to let you go for as long as you like and sell the latest version of Open Book for us, or to us, and then to talk about the future. So tell us all the good things about Open Book Ruby Edition.
Well, I obviously think that it's the best reading product that anyone could possibly want.
That surprises me.
You know, and and that, you know, it's just going to keep getting better. And And I think that the best way to make that decision is for someone to try it out. And if they want to try out competitive products, they will be the most informed consumer and make the best decision for their situation. And I understand that sometimes that may mean that they will choose a competitive product. I've always believed that our job at Ark and Stone is to give people a product that is the best we possibly can build. And I believe that if people sit down and look at the benefits of that, that they'll pick us more often than not. I think that's been our experience and one that we're hoping to build on. The specific benefits that come to people who choose to work with Ark and Stone, I think we have the best optical character recognition. I think our dual OCR technology engine that we've built from sort of the best of breed pieces from different parts of the OCR process has had great payoff and is a large part of some of the excitement around Ruby. I think that our user interface is very well designed, and that I think actually we've built two different interfaces to serve two different parts of our customer base. One, we've honored the classic OpenBook interface that we came out with many years ago so that people who are used to that can continue to use it comfortably. And I think we've done the best implementation of a standard Talking Windows interface that we think is very strong and will help people who are used to using screen readers or people who are thinking about using screen readers understand how Windows Talking interfaces should work. Because, of course, the job of screen readers is to try to take a generally intractable world and whip it into shape, and it's often good for someone who's starting to get an experience for how it should work so that they know what they should try first and in the more commercial applications that aren't always as cooperative. And I could wax eloquent about the 200 or 300 different improvements that we've put into OpenBook based on the user feedback that we have gotten from users of prior versions. One of the things that we do at Ark and Stone is we keep a database of all of the user suggestions, and when we do a major release, we go through the entire list. And those enhancements that are requested by a fair number of people, and for instance, if we have a feature that's requested by 5 people, I have to believe that there are 500 or 1,000 people who want it. So it's not. But I don't need all 500 people to speak up, but I figure that 5 people who take the time to let us know are speaking for a much larger audience. That drives an awful lot of our development. Our goal in each significant release is to deliver a handful of really exciting new features and then, 50 or 100, let's say, of the more everyday mundane things that users have just said, gee, I'd rather it work this way rather than that way, or if I could only do X, I'd be really happy. Or, in version 1, it used to work this way, and then you left it out, and I really think it should be back. Things like that.
In terms of the demo, how do people obtain that? What's the best way of doing that?
Right now, we send the demo free to anyone who requests it, and they send email to info@arkandstone.org, or they can call our telephone number or visit us at a trade show. Whatever mechanism works. And I'm sure at the end we'll kind of go through those contact points. And we're also working on putting the demo up on our website so that people can download it. One of the challenges we face is the full demo is, 120 megabytes, and we're trying to basically chop down the demo, not to have all the things that are on the CD, but just allow people to be able to install and run the product. And get a feeling for it without having to download, every spare HP driver that that we have on the hard drive, or every language on the via voice text-to-speech engine that we have on our standard product.
However, on a good cable or DSL connection, it'll be with you before you finish a cup of coffee.
Yes, and that's one of the reasons why we decided to do this, and now we're just trying to zip the thing up. There are people who told us that a 50 megabyte download is acceptable. So
yep.
We're going to go ahead and make that available. I don't think right now we've gotten that working and posted, but that's something that we're planning to do in the next month or two. So let's say by October.
And what are the limitations of the demo?
The demo is a full version of the product, that has a 30-day eval technology built into it. So we bought a some standard technology for making demos. And but you know, for the 30 days, you'll get a little notice that comes up and says how many days you have left, and then you get the full access to the product. It'll scan, do whatever you want it to do, so you can try out the product.
If you were able to buy OpenBook Ruby over the phone yourself with a credit card or whatever, can the demo be unlocked, or do you have to get a new disk shipped?
What we do for people who, let's say, get to day 29 or 30 and then decide to buy it, is we will issue an unlock code over the telephone or over email. Actually, email is the easiest thing because you can just cut and paste the unlock codes and the like. And we'll take the order, we'll unlock it for another 30 days, and then mail the person the full version of the product.
Okay.
Including the documentation and all, you know, the regular CD and all that.
And what's in the future for Arkenstone? And as part of this, I just wonder whether you can comment on whether you think there will ever come a time where blind people will no longer need blindness-specific OCR products.
Well, I'll answer that question first. I thought when I started Arkenstone that by this time the need for reading systems would have vanished. That there would be standard cheap PCs that would do OCR and talk and have natural voices and be more or less, you know, dirt cheap. And I think that the prices have certainly fallen by, you know, large factors. You know, I mean, if you were starting from scratch when we got started, you know, we took a 12,000-hour reading machine and made it possible to build a PC-based product for maybe $7,500. There are people who are selling complete reading machines right now based on the latest PCs for between $1,500 and $2,000. So the product has fallen by a factor of nearly five in price. So I believe that that sort of accessibility technology vanishing into the standard PC is going to happen. It's just not happening as fast as I think I would have liked. And our goal is that eventually the need for what we do will go away, but it doesn't seem like it's going to happen in the next year or two. I think that by bringing the product price points down to where they are, certainly many thousands more people can afford these products than would have been able to afford them in the past. Things that we're working on, one of the things that we have had in the past and I'm trying to get going on a much bigger scale, that is actually not a product as much as a program, is a loan program that makes it possible for unemployed people with disabilities to buy adaptive technology. And so that's a program that I'm working on very actively and been working with different disability groups. The whole concept of microloans is getting to be a hot one, and basically that people deserve not only access to information and access to technology, but also access to the credit that they need to acquire it. And it's a big barrier here for the people who don't fall into the category that has an employer buy the equipment, that doesn't have the government in the form of rehab or the educational system buying the equipment, or aren't from a family that can afford to buy the equipment outright. That's still a significant segment of the audience we want to help. In terms of product enhancements, I've had users describe the dream device that they would like. And this is a device that, I think this device was described to me by a very prominent German blind entrepreneur named Joachim Frank of Frank Audio Data. And he and I went on a walk around a German city, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago, and he described this device that would be on your belt, would have a GPS, know exactly where you are, would have a camera, would be able to look at the environment, read text out of the environment, recognize people, recognize situations, and more than just having access to all that information, would be tuned to your personal interests, because obviously the last thing someone wants is a personal assistant that is babbling at them nonstop. You know, basically would bring the information that a person would want for social purposes, economic purposes, personal business purposes, bring that all into availability so a person under their control could find out. So, for instance, if this device knew that you love smoked pork chops and you're walking by a grocery store and there's a big sale on smoked pork chops, say, ah, smoked pork chops at $1.49 a pound, you probably want to go ahead and get some. Or, you know, recognizes that the attractive person of the opposite sex that's, you know, 20 feet ahead is your type and sort of says...
God, I wonder if I could trust a computer to tell me that.
Well, you know, again, we're aiming very high here, but you know, I mean, I think that technology can do a great deal more, and a lot of this technology is in development in some form, and our goal is to bring... is to try to find when that technology is in a form where it's close to being ready and then make it available to people. And of course, initially it'll be available to people who are more technical, more forgiving of the infancy of the technology, but eventually you want a product that will deliver the information that you're not getting because of a disability in the form you can consume it, when you want it, and in the highest value form. So in other words, don't spew tons of data at me when all you really wanted to say was there are pork chops in the window. You might want to stop here.
It'll be a fascinating dinner party conversation, wouldn't it? In fact, I think it would be a dinner party conversation stopper if someone said, well, how did you meet your wife? And you replied, well, my Arkenstein computer actually introduced us. You know.
That's right, you know. And but, you know, having someone describe what they want and not putting conditions like, oh, we can't build that today on it, really brings home what people are experiencing and what needs they have. And my brain, which is an engineer's brain, just loves sort of walking around with this sort of set of problems in my head looking for solutions. And, you know, yesterday I had a scientist from a prominent development lab from a company that I'll leave nameless at this moment because we have confidentiality, who described three or four really cool user interface technologies that they're developing, and we instantly came up with four possible products, two of which would be interested in low vision people and two of which would be interested in blind people. And, you know, they're all in the directions of this dream machine that I just described, and it was so exciting to find someone saying, yeah, we have a prototype of this, and well, no, we can't do your full dream machine, but this part of it, you know, we could show it to you working, you know, maybe in the next 6 months. I would love to see that. And whether or not Arkenstein brings that product to market or somebody else brings that product to market, I really enjoy the role of saying, yes, people need that. Or, well, you might think people need that, but actually, they don't want that at all. At least not from what I've heard. So you might want to think more in this direction. And that's the rewarding part of being involved in product development and technology.
And we've come a nice full circle, really, because we talked at the beginning of the interview about how your college professor said the reading machine you wanted to build wasn't possible, at least the way that you were trying to do it. And here we have new technology that's on the horizon that you're dreaming about and coming up with visions for.
Yeah, and, you know, we're going to be working on short-term, medium-term, and long-term improvements, hopefully all simultaneously without losing focus of what we have to do this year for folks.
Now, contacting Arkenstein, if people want to follow up, what are means of contacting Arkenstein?
Okay. We're, you know, the Internet is a great way to reach us. We have an info@arkenstein.org email box that is our sort of general information. We also have a sales one and a tech one for people who have technical questions. Our website is www.arkenstein.org. Our telephone number inside the United States and Canada is 800-444-4443, and internationally it's 1 for the U.S., 650-603-8880. Let's see, I'm sure there's got to be some other contact information I should...
That should get people going, though, I imagine.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. And our address, the easiest address is Arkenstone Inc., P.O. Box 215, Moffett Field, M-O-F-F-E-T-T, Field, California, 94035-0215, USA.
We nearly forgot the snail mail.
That's right. Isn't there it? Are some folks for whom it's the most convenient thing, and I know that you have an international audience, so it's important to give people lots of options.
Well, Jim, this has been a real pleasure. I appreciate you spending over an hour with us, and we'll keep in touch with Arkenstone in the future, I'm sure.
Okay, thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to speak.